And now,
the definition. Definition.
Now, I know much of your work emphasizes how neoliberalism is a calculated project necessitated by corporate capitalism. It was never intended to be a rational project. It was intended to solidify class power. In a recent article of yours published on Truthdig, you quote David Harvey, who says, quote, "It's important to recognize the class origins of this project, which occurred in the 1970s when the capitalist class was in a great deal of difficulty. Workers were well organized and were beginning to push back. Like any ruling class, they needed ruling ideas," end quote. Harvey clarifies that neoliberalism was so successful amongst the emerging generation of the time because it appealed to a broader cultural desire for freedom. But instead of acknowledging that desire in context to social justice or change, the capitalist class channeled it into the marketplace. So do you think this message has stayed the same today, or has it adapted to the wants and needs of this generation? Like, how have we been duped again through, say, the notion that the gig economy is our generation's entrepreneurial saving grace?
Right. Well, the gig economy is part of the con. What the gig economy is, it's just a new name for temporary contract employment with no benefits and no job security. Yeah, Harvey's right. I like his book on neoliberalism. It was written a while ago, but I think it's probably the best explanation of neoliberalism and how it functions as an ideology. It was designed by the ruling elites after the 1960s to cope with what the political scientist Samuel Huntington called our excess of democracy. As an economic theory, it was always an absurdity. It drew from these very marginal, discredited figures like Friedrich Hayek. I mean, they'd even go around and quote the third-rate novelist Ayn Rand, Milton Friedman. It never made any economic sense, but it was used as an ideology to discredit mainstream Keynesian economists within the academy, within the IMF, the World Bank, and within government, and sold to the media, and essentially as an ideology was promoted to carry out deregulation, the destruction of labor unions, government oversight, austerity, and you're right, it was a conflated as with freedom. And that's, of course, after the revolutions in Eastern Europe, which freed themselves from communist control, the neoliberal economists from the Chicago School came in and gave them the same talk, that freedom of the market was about individual liberty and freedom of choice. And, of course, what it really was about, or which we are now experiencing, is corporate tyranny. And I think that what we're seeing at this moment in history is what Gramsci would call the interregnum. And that is when the ruling ideology has lost its credibility and is no longer has any currency across the political spectrum on the right or the left. Remember, Donald Trump was running around saying he wouldn't take money from Goldman Sachs. And that is a very dangerous moment for the ruling elites, because once a population no longer buys or believes in the ideology that justifies the ruling elite, then the institutions that buttress the ruling class inevitably begin to deflate and ultimately collapse. And that's what we're watching now with the Trump presidency. So at that moment, and Alexander Berkman writes about this in his essay, "The Idea is the Thing," at that moment, you have a battle of ideas that begins to percolate almost below the surface. And it's a battle that the corporate state is losing. And that's why they are becoming much more draconian in terms of their control. They're turning more to coercion. But we haven't yet, I think, articulated an alternative vision. And so there is political ferment within the United States as the ruling ideology loses credibility. But as long as the ideas that are rising to take its place are inchoate, the state can maintain power. You otherwise, opposition is just chaotic or even anarchic. And I think that's where we are, that we're struggling to articulate a new vision. But we all have recognized that the ideology that's peddled by the ruling classes is a con. And I think that comes from every aspect of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm. I think about this magical thinking. Another word for it that I've used is the prosperity gospel, which is what I've seen a lot in mega churches. This idea that Jesus wants you to have a new Cadillac. Jesus wants you to have, you know, that 4-bedroom house and the 2-car garage, you know, and if you just keep following this path, then you will be rewarded with these material goods. And I do think it makes sense when people have been up against so much hardship that they are looking for a way out and they do want the system that has oppressed them to collapse. And I know that it's been suggested that one way to curb the rise of Christian fanaticism is to reintegrate disenfranchised right-wing communities back into the economic system. But I'm wondering...
Well, that's how I conclude my book. I mean, I said the only way you're going to break this movement is to reintegrate them into the economy. Trying to argue them out of creationism isn't going to work.
But what exactly does this mean when our economic system is clearly broken and the dollar might implode altogether in the next decade or so, or, you know, the next economic crash will happen?
Well, then it means they'll be empowered even further and become more fanatic. So, I mean, this is, you know, the Nazis, and I'm not telling you that Trump is Hitler or the Christian right or Nazis, but we do learn from history. So the Nazis are polling in the single digits in 1928, then you have the 1929 crash, and you have Ebert and the Social Democrats in the Weimar Republic imposing draconian forms of austerity, including abolishing unemployment insurance, and the Nazis' popularity explodes. So the danger is that the longer the liberal elites remain ineffectual and refuse to address in a meaningful way the root causes behind the disintegration within society, the more these fanatics and charlatans and con artists and demagogues are empowered. And I watched that in Yugoslavia with the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia in the late 1980s. And you vomited up figures like Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tuđman for the same reason.
Mm-hmm. So by welcoming them back into the economic system, meaning into a unionized economic system, or, you know, maybe the economic system of our dreams, you know, something that isn't so, just corrupted. Because I'm wondering, if welcoming them back into a corrupted economic system, how does that support support the health of our societies? Or what, I don't know if I'm just kind of looking for the devil in the details here.
Well, but you can't welcome them back into a system that doesn't give them economic stability and a sense that they can find a place within society, and that the society is a form of meritocracy. In essence, it really boils down to having a sense of hope. I mean, I covered Yitzhak Rabin and the Oslo Agreement, and Rabin understood, number one, that the occupation was poisonous to Israel itself, but also, more importantly, that if the Palestinians had a stake in the Israeli economy, if Ahmed could find a good job in Tel Aviv and go back and buy a refrigerator in Gaza for his family and send his kids to school, you would do far more to mitigate fanaticism and even terrorism. And that's correct. So if we don't pretty radically reconfigure the economy into a form of socialism that protects and provides services to the working class and the working poor, then these problems will only get worse. That it's, you know, all of the kind of theorists of revolution have been quite clear about, you know, what it is that causes a revolution. Crane Brinton in Anatomy of a Revolution is, you know, one of the best books on this. But one of the most important elements is a sense that you can find a place within the society where you have the possibility of advancement. And when that is taken away from you, and when you know it's taken away from your children, then this creates huge distortions that give rise to these kind of radical or fanatical movements that we're seeing within the United States.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Fire Mayor Deese. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. How y'all doing? Well, I want to warn people about something. I think I've only come across three people who I think get this. And, you know, I've recognized now, as I am a man, I tend to more readily attract to male sources than female sources. I do, and I do listen to and have read several books by females that still influence me to this day, but it's just a fact of the matter. You know, I'm a guy, and I tend to watch a lot more guys when it comes to politics than I do women. Now, the three people I think that get this, what I'm about to talk about, and a fourth one may be Michael Moore, but definitely, actually no, a fourth one would be Michael Moore. Gerald Horn, who's in a historian, if you don't know who he is. Morris Berman, who is an author. And Chris Hedges. All of them get this and have helped me to get this over the last 10 years. This year has been the first year I've had to actually wrestle with accepting this fact, though. Because this is going to have huge consequences for the country over the coming decade or more. And I mean, this has always been here. That's what gets me, is it's always been here. I've just not wanted to see it. So what am I talking about? The United States of America may actually become so distorted thanks to this entity known as Donald Trump, that it may be difficult, if not impossible, to recover from it. Now, I want to be very fair here. The distortion isn't Donald Trump's fault. Donald Trump merely distorted the distortion farther and probably way more quicker. Again, thanks to Morris Berman for helping me understand that. If we hadn't had a Donald Trump, the distortion would have still been there, but it would have moved along rather slowly. What is this distortion? For lack of a better term, in fact, this is probably the best term that I can come up with, I want to call it disillusionment. Or no, I'm sorry, that's the wrong word. I said disillusionment. I meant illusionment. Most people, I think, believe that the United States has a very realistic view of the world. And the people in the United States have very realistic view of the world. What I'm starting to understand is Europeans have seen the United States citizenry always through the lens of romantics. They believe we are hyperly romantic. We have this pretty and almost euphorically hopeful view of the world. We are always optimistic, or at least the wealthy are. For this reason, the poor, especially over the last 100 or so years, have become unnecessarily optimistic and almost delusionally optimistic. We believe that with enough work and enough effort, we will be able to ascend success. We will be able to grab at and hold fame. And not fame like the celebrities use fame. I'm talking fame in our own right. To be acknowledged, patted on the head, praised for what we could do for the wealthy and for corporations and for our communities, that type of thing. It's different. There has been people who have worked themselves into the graves, into an early grave at that, for the last 100 plus years, believing that things would get better because they worked themselves to death. Now, obviously, things did get better in the 1950s and 60s, particularly for white people. But some black people and brown people, red people, did get to appreciate that too. But understand something. Even when it comes to those gains, it was still because we found an ally among the wealthy to do the work that we needed done. Many of the wealthy at that time were begging for and clamoring for a dictator, a fascist strongman. Thankfully, we didn't get that. But the people who worked themselves into the early grave didn't know that there would be a 1930s, didn't know that, thankfully, there would be an FDR. These people in the late 1800s to early 1900s worked themselves to death believing that success would come. Now, because I am a deep believer in reincarnation. And I believe that just like Native Americans believed, there were four seasons to life. The winter is the one that we really don't talk about. That comes after death. And then we become children again in the spring. I look at the society and the distortion that I mentioned as something that has taken place and taken hold over time. It's not new. You see, and I brought this up to a friend of mine who's a conservative and a big Trump supporter. The people screaming loudest for their freedom, never in the history of this country, except for a fleeting moment, had to work for it. Now, you may say that's unfair, but the fact of the matter is, it's not unfair. You see, because oftentimes, if I was to say the same statement over again, that the people screaming the loudest about, you know, wanting their freedom didn't ever have to work for it, the first thing that you may think is, well, you're talking about white people. Well, white people had to do this. White people had to do that. No, ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about a specific group of white people. Recently, I listened to a very good book written by Upton Sinclair. A book that I have to be honest with you, I've come across before, and embarrassingly, I didn't listen to or read. The book is called 100%, The Story of an American Patriot. This book, as do many of the books that I read from that era, this is the beginning of the 1900s, gives a startling portrayal of a man who finds himself in a situation and turns it into a, well, I won't be ruining much telling you this, turns it into an opportunity of a lifetime. He becomes a police informant. And through his eyes, through his ventures, we see what real Americans do to protect the freedoms that, truthfully, they don't even really get to appreciate unless they become spies, unless they become informants. Nonetheless, for every informant, there was hundreds, thousands, even hundreds of thousands of people who believed in the myth that America was a meritocracy, and that by turning on their fellow citizen, if that citizen didn't salute the company correctly, if they talked badly and wanted to organize workers, there were hundreds of thousands of people per informant who worked not for the benefit of the society, but for the benefit of those who ran society. This distortion is old, ladies and gentlemen. This group of Americans that I'm talking about, when I say those people yelling about their, about wanting their freedom, never had to work for those freedoms a day in their life, these people are the ones that have constantly and consistently sided in their minds, in their hearts, in their actions with the people who run the society. Even when the people who ran the society was in the wrong, and when the people who they were opposing were trying to fight for things that their children would benefit from. This is what I'm talking about when I say that. It's Sambo from Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's Sambo from Uncle Tom's Cabin. It is the one who has the opportunity to turn away from Master, but goes and works for Master. But it is also the many who stand behind Sambo and allow Sambo to get away with his work. The distortion is rooted in these people. Now, this is the one thing that I disagree with Chris Hedges on. And maybe, I disagree with Chris Hedges because as a black man, and I think he's starting to see this more and more and more. I may be able to fool myself about society for a while, which I did for a long time. But, you know, I have to wake up sooner or later, or I'll sacrifice too much. And you know, I'm waking up slowly but surely. The one area that I disagree with Chris Hedges on is that this comes from a culture of despair. Now, maybe in the minds of white people, sure, they're despairing. But I don't think it's because of the economics. Yes, these people are economically hurt. Yes. But I actually really do believe, and I think Chris Hedges has talked about this, so I guess I wouldn't say I disagree with him, you know, altogether. But what's really driving this is the demographic change. These people are looking around and realizing the demographics are changing and they are no longer in the driver's seat. No matter what they do, they're no longer in the driver's seat. At the same time, their creations are crumbling. They don't have to be. But because of that distortion, which says this is a meritocracy when it's not, they're not taking care of what they've built. And they refuse to do what's necessary to take care of what they built. Which then almost, you know, inevitably leads to the decay of what they built. And as they see the decay, they still do nothing about it. Now, apart from this, towards that distortion, you have had a country that established itself within 50 years to have at least three, maybe four types of freedom. You had those that were really free, those who had the money to do whatever they wanted to do. Those who were kind of marginally free, you know. They had a little bit of money. They had to work a lot to make it, but they still had a little bit of money. They were, you know, entrusting. I apologize. I actually went down to, like, the third level, but they had a little bit of money. And they, you know, they had to entrust their life to the people at the top. And then you had those who had less money than the people at the top, but kind of they were kind of middle managers, you know. But they weren't as poor as the poorest, you know. And they had freedom so long as they could remain employed. They were kind of the middle class of the time. And they had freedom so long as they couldn't, like, travel overseas and stuff, but they pretty much could go throughout the country because they had the right amount of money. They knew the limits of their freedom, and their freedom gave them enough leisure to be able to take advantage of the limits and the expanses at the same time. And then there were those who were not free at all and never would be free and never could be free. Most of them were black, brown, red, and yellow. They were non-white. They were Irish. And a few other countries in Europe who were looked at as kind of the white trash of the group. This country decided that it would have those four types of freedoms. And we have had those four types ever since. Now, the fifth type, yeah, they were the informants. They were different. They kind of came up after the Civil War, even though they were there before the Civil War. But as industrialization swept the country, more and more informants, especially once when we start talking about the age of labor union activity, more and more informants became necessary. Which, by the way, you should read 100% because it gives you a very interesting take on policing. These four types of freedom distorted the country. And those four types still exist today. They haven't gone away. They still distort the country. The problem is, we've never sought to rectify that, to heal it. And so now, we are in a position, in a place, where we have to rectify it. Because, as I've said to you many times before, ladies and gentlemen, there is no fundamental reason why we are working 40-hour weeks anymore. There is work that should be done, yes. There is work that needs to be done, yes. But you know something? We shouldn't be working 40 hours a week to do it. In fact, if we're working 20 hours, that's kind of the limit. We should be in an age of intense leisure, growing our intellect, growing our community spirit, growing our cooperation, growing all of the things that makes life worth living. That's what we should be doing, but we're not, because wealthy people need to get wealthier. We are in an age where we are being confronted with that. We have to take care of the important things. And most of the important things, ladies and gentlemen, you can't make a profit off of. Reforestization across the world, you can't make a profit off of that. Going out and cleaning up the oceans, which we can do, you can't make a profit off of that. Investing in investing in decentralizing of the electricity grid, making sure that each home, each building is sustainable electricity-wise by itself, so it can hold, it can provide its own power. You ain't going to be able to make a profit off of that. Cleaning up these horrific chemical sites, you can't make a profit off of that. The government should be building massive, massive chemical rehabilitation and recycling centers for chemicals. Because you can't make a profit off of it. We should be doing that, but we're not. We should be, but we're not. Because people are all in this mindset of we need to make a profit. If we are going to live, if we are going to survive, we are going to have to get away from that profit motive crap. These four freedoms in this time period are going to have to be resolved. The problem is, so many European Americans believe in them. So many of them believe in them. You know, I mentioned reincarnation earlier. One of the things that I've often thought about, you know, when I talk to my conservative friends and they say, you know, I've earned this, I've earned this, I've earned this, and I look at what they've earned and I'm like, you still struggle. I mean, you still struggle. What are you talking about? What have you really earned? Oh, yeah, well, I'd be, you know, I'm better off here than in, you know, socialist Venezuela or whatever. And I say, how do you even know that? But then one day I thought about it, and I go, you know something? Let's say, as a European American, you have lived in the United States of America over the last 200-something years. Let's say you've lived here 6, 7, 8 times. Or maybe even you've lived here 4 or 5 times. And every single time you've been poorer than dirt. And now in this lifetime, you're not. Now, somewhere deep inside of you, a part that you don't remember, you do remember all of those hard lives that you spent in this country. And now you have a lifetime where everything is fine. Decently fine. Do you maybe think those other lifetimes where you worked hard, they're going to scream through you and make you think, yeah, you've earned this quasi-good life. Yes, not everything is taken care of, but compared to where you came from, oof, this is a walk in the park. That's just a thought, though. Maybe I'm crazy. This distortion, in other words, ladies and gentlemen, unless we deal with it, it's not going away. And considering now, as we move out of 2020, white people are dealing more and more and more with the demographic change, I think this distortion is really presenting itself so we can try to deal with it. Because if we don't deal with it, I'm afraid that it's going to rip us apart. It's going to do some serious damage. The country is too divided. Now, I'm going to take a break here. Then I'm going to come back on the other side with more Class War Battlefield Podcasts. Stay with me. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alone.